Under Enemy Colors, A.O. Pollard. The night was pitch black, absolutely ideal for the job, reflected Second Lieutenant Martin Westlake of the Royal Flying Corps, provided he did not lose his bearings, which, in his youthful self-confidence, he did not think at all likely. His task would be completed and he would be on his way home again in less than an hour. 5 kilometers northeast of the G in Veldehem, the colonel had said. Shut off your engine and glide down to 1,500 feet before you give the signal to jump. Martin glanced over the side of his cockpit. There was very little to be seen except a feathery layer of cloud, but through a gap 20,000 feet below him, he glimpsed the everlasting very lights which marked the position of the opposing trenches. They were over the lines then, and from now on he would have to keep his eyes skinned for signs of enemy scouts. If he was spotted before he had dumped his cargo, the whole show would have to be abandoned. The cargo, seated grim and silent in the rear cockpit, was a Belgian agent who was being dropped by parachute to glean some vital information for the intelligence corps, beyond the fact that the green-tabbed major who brought him to the aerodrome had introduced him as Monsieur Jacques Pouliere. Martin knew nothing whatever about him. From various rumours that had been circulating for the past month, however, he guessed that the spy's mission was connected with an expected German push. Aerial photographs had revealed the presence of a number of new dumps behind the enemy lines, and no doubt intelligence were anxious to ascertain the approximate date when the assault would begin. Martin kept steady on his course for another 10 minutes. At the end of that time, he calculated he ought to be in the vicinity of Roulers. It was a German railhead, and he was well aware from a reconnaissance made a few days earlier that there was a big concentration of troops in the neighbourhood. Had the night been clearer, the sky would have been alive with searchlight beams, and he would have been lucky to get by without a challenge. After Roulers, it should be safe enough to drop down to 10,000 feet or even less. If a Hun searchlight unit caught him in a beam so far into enemy territory, the black crosses pasted on the underside of his lower wings would convince him that he was one of their own pilots. Better give it another 5 minutes to make sure. Veldehem was only 10 kilometers farther on. Even if the wind had veered a bit and he was off his estimated track, he should have no difficulty in spotting the place where Pouliere was to leave him once he got below the clouds which had stood him in such good stead. "You can't make any mistake," the colonel had assured him. "There's a river with the railway crossing it at right angles. If Pouliere drops off when your leading edge cuts the point of intersection, he should land just right." The 5 minutes was up at last, and closing down his throttle, Martin put the nose of his Bristol fighter into a glide. At every 2,000 feet fall in height, registered on the altimeter, he reopened his throttle and flew for half a minute to prevent his engine getting too cold, then throttled back again and continued his descent. He was down to 8,000 feet, and still the cloud was too dense for him to make out any landmarks from which to check his position. According to time reckoning, he ought to be very close to his objective. For the first time, he wished that visibility was a trifle clearer. Should he risk going down a little lower, or would it be better to fly about until he found a rift which would give him a peep at the ground? The problem was acute. If he flew around and failed to find a break, he might lose himself. On the other hand, if he went lower and was spotted before he was ready to dump his passenger, he might jeopardize Pouliere's chances of an undetected landing. No great imagination was needed to visualize Pouliere's fate if he fell into enemy hands. There would be a drumhead court-martial followed by a dawn parade for a firing squad. A Belgian spy was too sharp a thorn in the German plans for any expectation of leniency. All the same, he would have to do something, and going lower appeared to be the lesser of two evils. But Martin made a mental reservation as he closed the throttle for a further descent. If he had booed badly and made altogether the wrong landfall, he would climb back into the sky again and return to the aerodrome as fast as his engine would take him. He might incur the severe displeasure of the intelligence corps and of his superior officers in general. He might have to endure the ribald jests of his light-hearted companions in the mess. But he was hanged if he was going to have Pouliere's death on his conscience through his inability to locate the right spot for dropping him, even if the fellow was only a Gonzubri spy. Peering ahead through the murk, with one eye on the falling needle of his altimeter, Martin wondered anxiously if the clouds would ever break. 6,000 feet... 5,000, 4,000, 3,000, and still the ground was totally invisible. This was the very devil. It was madness to go any lower. Unless by the one chance in a million he had struck the exact spot for Pouliere to get off, his presence would inevitably be discovered. Martin cursed softly under his breath. However much he disliked the change of plan, there was only one thing to be done. He must reopen his engine and cruise around until he found the break in the clouds that had so far eluded him. Savagely pushing his throttle fully open, he eased back his control column and began to climb. 3,000 feet was much too low. He ought to have had the sense to stick at 5,000. The engine responded smoothly, and for some 30 seconds ran with an unfaltering note. Then suddenly it spat. Psst! It spat again, an ominous warning that would not be ignored. Wise with the experience of 2 months' active service on the Western Front, Martin instinctively retarded the throttle to 2/3. Probably the carburettors were not filling fast enough to supply gas for 4 revolutions. The remedy appeared to take effect, and for a minute and a half the engine functioned normally. But before Martin had had time to recover from the scare the temporary failure had given him, the rhythmic roar died abruptly to nothingness. Was it fuel? Magnetos? A mechanical brake? The queries chased one another through Martin's mind as he instinctively depressed the nose of the Bristol into a glide. If it was a fuel stoppage, he might get away with it yet. If ignition or mechanical trouble, he had not a chance. Feeling for the petrol tap, he switched over to the reserve tank. By diving steeply, the rush of air would revolve the propeller sufficiently to make the cylinders fire. Pray God she would pick up. A hand clutched his shoulder and shook him with the fury of desperation.
Kietil?
Asked Poulier fearfully.
What's the matter?
His voice sounded unnaturally loud in the dead silence that had succeeded the engine failure.
Engine stopped, snapped Martin.
Mon Dieu, what is going to happen to me?
He might have included me, thought Martin cynically. With those black crosses on the wings, a British pilot could expect short shrift. The Belgian, in civilian clothes and in his own territory, stood at least an even chance.
Hold tight, I'm going to dive,
announced Martin shortly. He held forward his control column until the wind was screaming through the bracing wires. Ahead of him, he could see the propeller flapping round in spasmodic jerks. But although he waggled the throttle backwards and forwards, there was not so much as a cough from the defunct power unit. The Bristol was down below 1,000 feet before he gave it up. It was no blinking use trying any longer. He would have to face the unpleasant fact of a forced landing behind the enemy lines. A nasty lump kept rising in his throat as he looked wildly about him. He was so young to die. It would be his 21st birthday in a month, and he had hoped for special leave to celebrate it at home. It would not have been so bad to have gone out in a scrap, but there was something terrifying in the prospect of facing a firing squad. A blubbing sound behind him cut through his fears like a knife. Poulier was evidently in a blue funk too. Surely he had more spunk than a common Gonzubri spy, Martin told himself firmly. Of course he had. He had been entrusted with this job, and he would see it through. Whatever happened to him afterwards, there was no reason why he should not drop Poulier according to plan. The colonel had been insistent that Poulier's mission was of vital importance. Exerting all his willpower, he brought himself under control.
"Listen to me, Monsieur Poulier," he cried over his shoulder. "Pull yourself together, man. You're going to be all right, even if I'm not. Get ready to jump, and I'll land as far away from you as I can."
He had to repeat himself twice before the terrified Belgian grasped his meaning. When at last he understood, his extravagant joy was as nauseating as his former despondency.
"It is that I shall be safe after all. Oh la la, monsieur, this is a bit of all right. I am so happy, yes."
A sudden thought struck his happiness from him.
"But where shall I land? Will it be safe country? Cannot you take me to the place agreed?"
"No, I damn well can't."
What a swine the fellow was.
"As far as I can tell, we're to the southwest of Veldhem instead of the northeast. You'll have to make the best of it."
"What a pity. I am not sure."
"Nor am I. Not of anything. Now get your parachute ready and prepare to jump when I tell you."
Martin glared in furious concentration at the earth beneath. He would be thundering glad to get rid of this self-centered blighter. Facing the music in his company would be too humiliating. Steadying the Bristol into the wind, he directed his passenger in climbing over the side of the cockpit. When he was finally in position for the drop, with his finger in the ring attached to the ripcord of his parachute, Martin gave him his final instructions.
"When I say now, just let go of everything and count 3 slowly before you pull. The envelope will open immediately and you'll be as right as ninepence. Now!"
Poulier stared at him in wide-eyed terror. His mouth was working.
"Now?"
he echoed weakly.
"Yes, now! Go on, man, jump!"
"No! No, I can't.
You can and you've got to."
Leaning back, Martin brought down his fist on the spy's gripping fingers. The unexpected pain made him release his hold, but realizing he was beginning to fall, he made a wild clutch with the hand which was holding the ripcord.
In doing so, his thumb jerked the ring and the pilot parachute was drawn from the case. The wind whisked it aft and it fluttered over the top of the tail unit, dragging the main envelope after it. "Jump, you fool!" yelled Martin fiercely. Appreciating the danger of the apparatus becoming entangled in the tailplane, he struck again and again at Poulier's hands. "My God!" The exclamation was forced from him as his worst fears were realized. Poulier, unable to maintain his hold against Martin's furious onslaught, had dropped off into space. At the same instant, the flapping envelope, caught in a sudden gust of wind, had wrapped itself round tailplane and elevator, and the spy was now swinging helplessly 20 feet below the fuselage. The Bristol was no higher than 800 feet. Unless by some miracle the tangled parachute freed itself in the next few seconds, Poulier must be dashed to death against the rapidly approaching Earth. Nor was this the sum total of the disaster. Poulier's weight, acting on the flimsily constructed elevator, was tending to drag the control downwards, thus accelerating the gliding angle into a steep dive. Martin braced himself against the joystick to counteract the movement, but in doing so he rendered himself impotent to control his approach and subsequent landing. The next few moments were a nightmare. Wild thoughts raced through Martin's mind as he tried to find a solution to his dilemma. If only there were some way he could release the envelope from its entanglement. Had his engine been functioning, he could have climbed higher and endeavored to cast it loose in a stunt, but with his motor dead, he was powerless. He dare not release the control column and attempt to scramble back along the fuselage at that low altitude. There was no time. Hell! The aircraft sank lower and lower. Martin thought bitterly of the task he had set out so light-heartedly to accomplish. He had failed miserably. He had let down his squadron and the British Army. Green tabs would wait in vain for his information. In another few seconds, 20 at the most. Crack! The control column went limp in his hand. Great Scott, what had happened? He turned swiftly. The parachute had disappeared. The combination of Poulier's weight and the force of the wind had proved too much for the starboard elevator. It had broken away from its hinges, allowing the Belgian to fall clear. Martin barely had time to notice the envelope fluttering earthwards. His attention was at once fully occupied in fighting to retain the mastery of his crippled machine. With half the elevator gone, the Bristol was in imminent danger of crashing. 500 feet to go. Despite the fact that he was holding her up almost to stalling point, the speed of descent was increasing. Kicking over his rudder, he went into a sideslip with the remaining port elevator uppermost. That was better. Perhaps if he kept like that, the shock of the underwing striking the ground would give him a sporting chance of escape from serious injury. What about Poulier? The white upper surface of the parachute was just visible through the darkness. Although it appeared to be almost at ground level, the envelope was fully open. Martin experienced a surge of thankfulness. Even if he were killed, it looked as though his job was finished after all. However it had come about, the bally spy was landed. He had a blurred impression of the ground below him, a patch of water, the dark outline of a wood, a house. There were no lights to be seen anywhere in the neighborhood. Perhaps... Zunk! The starboard wing hit an invisible tree, crumpled. Martin felt his aircraft shudder, check. Then it plunged nose foremost to the ground. Afterwards, he was never quite sure what actually happened. The tree must have acted as a buffer, he decided. One instant he was facing death, the next he was picking himself out of a large hawthorn bush that made an extremely painful cushion. Though thoroughly shaken by his experience, he stood for a minute or two trying to pull himself together. By all that was wonderful, he was alive. Except for hawthorn scratches, he was unhurt. The sound of hurrying feet reminded him that he was in enemy territory. His mind adverted instantly to the black crosses on the wings. He was rejoicing a trifle too soon. He braced himself to face discovery. There was nothing he could do. He had no weapon, and even if he had possessed a brace of machine guns, he could not engage the entire might of Germany. Half a minute, though. Surely that was only one pair of feet. Perhaps if he overpowered this first arrival, he would have more time to remove those telltale crosses before any more enemies appeared. Without the evidence that revealed his secret mission, he would, since he was in uniform, be treated as an ordinary prisoner of war. The crosses made all the difference between life and a summary execution. Stepping cautiously behind the hawthorn bush, he waited with muscles tense for the enemy to appear. The footsteps were growing rapidly louder, quick, short paces that suggested a smallish man or possibly a woman. Great heaven! It was a woman, a girl, rather, slim and upright, walking with the grace of youth and health. He could see her outline distinctly as she advanced. She was dressed in a blouse and skirt with a shawl draped about her shoulders. Acting on the impulse of the moment, Martin moved to meet her. Assuming that she was a native of the district, he decided to throw himself on her mercy. At least she could tell him where he was. Seeing him emerge from his hiding place, Clotilde Moreau halted abruptly. One hand clutched her shawl at the neck in a gesture of alarm, but the voice with which she challenged him was perfectly steady.
Qui va là?
Je suis un officier anglais, mademoiselle. Martin could speak French fluently.
Anglais? You are English, monsieur, but how?
Martin laughed softly at the surprise in her tone. My aeroplane has alighted itself into this tree here. I fear from now on I shall be obliged to walk. Clotilde did not consider his jest at all humorous.
Oh la la, but this is terrible. The Germans will kill you if they find you.
Once again, Martin remembered the black crosses, and the inclination to joke faded away. Not if you will help me, mademoiselle, he begged earnestly. Will you? She looked at him uncertainly.
I will do what I can, of course, but it isn't very much. What do you want me to do?
Martin took her arm and led her to the wrecked aircraft. There are some black paper crosses pasted on the wings. We must scrape them off immediately. Water from the radiator will soften them. If the Germans saw them... Clotilde wrenched herself free.
Did you fly over here alone?
She demanded excitedly. Yes, of course. Why? The existence of Poulier must remain a secret even from his newfound ally.
You are sure you did not bring someone with you?
Perfectly sure. Clotilde sadly shook her head.
Perhaps you do not trust me, monsieur, but I know.
You know what?
That you did not come alone.
How can you possibly know that?
You carried a Belgian agent who was to be dropped near here by parachute.
Martin did not immediately reply. Her assertion was too correct to be mere guesswork. But how did she come to be in possession of such vitally important information? He decided to head her off with banter. You'll be telling me his name next, he remarked lightly.
That too, if you wish. It is Jacques Poulier.
Sacré nom. How can you know that? She shrugged her shoulders daintily.
It is very simple. Jacques is my fiancé, and I was expecting him.
Astounding though the revelation was, it filled Martin with relief. It assured him that he was amongst friends, and when Poulier presently put in an appearance, they might agree to hide him until he could be smuggled over the Dutch frontier. That certainly alters matters, he declared. Yes, you're right, mademoiselle. I did bring Monsieur Poulier with me. He went on to explain how the failure of his engine had upset their plans.
You're sure he got down all right?
Asked Clotilde anxiously. I see no reason to suppose otherwise. His parachute was fully extended.
In which direction was it falling?
Martin pointed to the west. Over there, I think, about half a mile. Here, I say. But she had gone, running swiftly into the night. Had it not been an urgent necessity to remove the paper crosses, Martin would have followed, but he dare not risk the possibility of their being discovered in his absence. Draining some water from the radiator, which was fortunately undamaged, he set to work. He found that the mechanics who had pasted them in position had made a thorough job of it, and hampered by the position of the wreck, the task of removal was painfully slow. He had not quite removed one sign when he heard a sound that made his blood run cold. It was a sharp word of command, and it was addressed to a line of shadowy forms spread out at regular intervals, advancing directly towards him. A detachment of German infantry methodically scouring the neighborhood. There could be little doubt about their objective. Someone had reported the fall of an unknown aircraft, and they were searching for its whereabouts. Martin made up his mind in a flash. He might not be able to avoid capture, but he was hanged if he would let them find those crosses. Seizing the petrol feed pipe, he wrenched with all his might. The copper tube snapped short, and a steady stream of fuel poured from the tank. He struck a match. It spluttered and went out. He struck another with a similar result. The wind was wicked. The approaching Germans were no more than 200 yards distant. Unless he was successful in the next few seconds, his ruse would be too late. Cupping his hands, he tried again with trembling fingers. The light flared, and he bent swiftly to apply it to the soaked fabric of the wreck. But for the third time, the wind proved his enemy. Wild thoughts crowded his mind. Dare he risk another? No, even if it lit, the enemy would be on the spot before the flames could destroy the evidence against him. What should he do? Give himself up or make a dash for it? If he surrendered, they were certain to shoot him. Very well, he would remain at liberty as long as he could. Keeping the aircraft between himself and the searchers, he walked swiftly through the little wood. Once clear of the trees, he broke into a run. In a few seconds, they would be looking for the missing pilot, but it would take them hours to search the whole district, and in the meantime, anything might happen. His one chance of escape was to find Poulier. The Belgian had friends in the neighborhood, as was evidenced by the arrival of the girl. If they would hide him for a day or two and give him some civilian clothes, he might succeed in making his way into Holland. The country he was traversing was partly ploughed stubble, and by avoiding the newly turned furrows, he left no footprints to guide his pursuers. Reaching a road, he crossed it and slowed to a walk. If only he had the vaguest idea where he was. Estimating his bearings as well as he could, he steered in the direction in which he judged Poulier to have landed. Hope and despair alternately buoyed him up and weighed him down. Nothing but the knowledge that those black crosses were equivalent to his death warrant kept him from abandoning the seemingly impossible task. It was ridiculous to imagine that Poulier would have remained in the one place. Once on the ground, he would have gone directly to his friends. They might be anywhere. At the same time, there was always a possible chance of meeting him, Martin told himself desperately. He had been walking for nearly 10 minutes, and his hopes were fading fast, when he spotted a patch of white flapping against the trunk of a tree. It was the abandoned parachute, and since it must have been blown to its present position, it suggested that Poulier had come down to windward of it. As he stood debating what to do next, Martin sensed rather than saw a slight movement on his left. At once, his pulse raced with anticipation of capture. Then he realized it was a single figure outstretched on the ground, and he sighed with relief. A moment later, he was kneeling beside the prostrate form of the man he sought. The spy was conscious, although he was in a very bad way. Both his legs were fractured, and his clothes were battered and torn where he had been drawn along the ground at the end of his parachute harness. With his heart torn with pity for the poor creature's plight, Martin raised his head and endeavored to make him more comfortable. Evidently, Poulier recognized him, for his features twisted into the semblance of a smile.
"It opened too late," he whispered. "I felt so hard, then it dragged me right across the field. Oh, oh!"
He blubbered distressfully at the recollection. "Poor old chap," said Martin softly. "What damnably hard luck. But try not to worry about it. Now I've found you, I'll see you're all right. I hate to leave you like this, but it's only to get help." Poulier slowly shook his head.
"It's no good, Monsieur Anglais. I'm finished."
"Nonsense," Martin tried to reassure him. "They'll have you in bed in no time." He rose abruptly to his feet and looked about him. There was only one thing to do in the circumstances, he told himself firmly. He must surrender immediately and appeal to the humanitarian instincts of his captors to attend to Poulier's injuries. The only thing that made him hesitate was the disagreeable fact of Poulier's calling. However much he tried to camouflage the accident, the Germans could not help but place the correct interpretation upon it. While he had no doubt that they would give all the attention necessary to his shattered limbs, Martin had an uneasy feeling that Poulier would inevitably be brought to trial once he was restored to health. Was anyone ever in such a damnable predicament, wondered Martin. It seemed utterly futile to hand Poulier over to his future executioners for medical treatment, but he must in common decency do something. But what could he do? If only the girl would turn up, she would know where to find a Belgian doctor. The man at his feet shuddered convulsively, and Martin bent over him once more. Poulier was trying to say something. His mouth was working, but no sound would come. His hand plucked feebly at his coat. Endeavoring to elucidate the message the injured man was attempting to convey, Martin felt in the ragged garment and drew out a packet of papers. Poulier's expression told him he was on the right track. "You wish me to destroy these?" he asked, and received a nod of affirmation. "Very well, but..." Martin got no further. Poulier's head had fallen limply to one side. Death had solved his problem for him, reflected Martin, and despite the pitiful tragedy of the spy's ending, could not help a feeling of relief. A moment later, the relief vanished from his mind to be replaced by an overwhelming dismay. As long as Poulier was alive, he had been too preoccupied to consider his own position. Now he realized that his last hope of succor had gone. He had been counting so much on Poulier's helping him. Without Poulier, he might as well have stayed by the smashed Bristol. Some of the Belgians might be willing enough to shelter him, but how was he to discover their whereabouts? In a British uniform with every German in the district on the lookout for him, he had as much chance of eluding capture as a mouse in a room full of cats. Almost at once, he perceived a way out of his dilemma. Why should he not change places with the dead man? He could speak French sufficiently well to pass as a Belgian, and if he wore Poulier's clothes and adopted his identity, there was a strong possibility that no German would succeed in penetrating his disguise. The idea was utterly reckless, no doubt, and would be overwhelmingly difficult to carry through, but surely any hazard was worth attempting when death was the sole alternative. No sooner had the thought formed in his mind than he set to work. Carrying the corpse deeper into the wood, he began the grisly task of stripping it. It was a slow and arduous job in the darkness, and it took over an hour before it was completed. With Poulier's remains now attired in the uniform of a Royal Flying Corps pilot, he reattached the harness of the parachute and arranged the body artistically to make it appear that death had resulted from a hard landing. Then, thrusting the Belgian's papers into the pocket of his own tattered garments, he prepared to run the enemy gauntlet. His intention was to make for the house he had glimpsed from the air immediately before the Bristol crashed. It lay on the farther side of the wreck, and he would have to be very careful how he approached it. The German search party would treat any civilian caught out at that time of night with scant courtesy. Retracing his steps from the wood, he was within a few hundred yards of the road when he became aware that a solitary figure was approaching diagonally across his path. At once, he stepped out of sight behind a group of haystacks. He did not yet feel sufficient confidence in his disguise to risk a premature encounter. The figure passed within a few feet of where he was standing, and peering through the darkness, he recognized the girl who had declared herself to be Poulier's fiancée.
"Hist!" he called softly. "Venez ici, mademoiselle. C'est moi."
Clotilde halted abruptly at his cry, and for a moment he thought she was going to bolt.
"Are you the Englishman?"
she asked incredulously. Martin emerged from his ambush.
"Yes, I..."
He broke off as she screamed in sudden panic. He had overlooked his changed appearance.
"Shush," he warned. "Please don't be frightened, I..." "Where is Jacques?"
she broke in.
"I've been searching for hours. There was a party of Germans and I was forced to hide."
Martin bit his lip, telling her it was not going to be very easy.
"I'm afraid he's met with an accident," he said slowly.
She caught her breath and clutched at her shawl.
"Is he dead?"
she whispered.
"Yes, mademoiselle."
He explained as briefly as he could, but when he revealed that he had stripped the dead man of his clothes, Clotilde protested violently.
"How could you do such a thing? It was sacrilege. How can he be buried in his own name when they think he is an English officer?"
It had not occurred to Martin that Poulier's relatives might consider his strategy offensive.
"I'm most terribly sorry, but it was the only thing I could do. I..." "Sorry?"
she cried contemptuously.
"What do I care for your sorrow? What about my sorrow and the sorrow of Jack's father and mother?"
For the life of him, Martin could not think of a suitable reply. He had believed that the local Belgian inhabitants would be ready and willing to assist him, but if they regarded his action as desecration of the dead, it looked very much as though he would be forced to fend for himself.
"I was only thinking of escaping my enemies," he confessed lamely. "I was hoping you would be willing to help me."
Clotilde shook her head furiously.
"I wouldn't help you if..." "What was that?"
She clutched fearfully at his arm. Listening intently, Martin could hear the faint clink of military accoutrements. The sound seemed to come from all around.
"Germans," he said tersely. "Then we must run. Quick, quick, this way."
She dragged him round the corner of the rick and would have dashed into the open had not Martin restrained her. There were more of the enemy on this side. He could see them advancing relentlessly in extended order. His mouth went suddenly dry as he realized they were surrounded. Someone must have heard the girl scream, with the result that the haystacks had been encircled by a cordon. This was the end. His little subterfuge could not avail him now. They might accept his story for the moment, but when they found Poulier's body so close to the site of his capture, the interference would be obvious. Besides, there were those papers in his pocket. He lugged them out and gave them to the girl.
"These must not be found, whatever happens," he declared earnestly. "They were Poulier's and will prove he was a spy."
"But what can I do with them?"
"Destroy them when you get a chance."
He lifted her to the top of a partly built rick.
"Lie low until they've gone," he whispered.
Squaring his shoulders, he raised his hands above his head and walked boldly into the open.
"Kamerad!"
he roared.
"Kamerad!"
There was a sharp word of command and the nearest section broke into a double. Rough hands seized Martin and hustled him before the commander of the detachment. The officer, an infantry captain, regarded his prisoner sternly in the light of a torch. He was decidedly peevish from having been ordered out of a comfortable mess to conduct the search, and he had no room for sympathy in his heart.
"Who are you, and where do you come from?" he demanded in raw French.
"Jacques Poulier of Veldhem," answered Martin meekly. "If it please you, monsieur."
"It doesn't please me at all. If you ask me, you're a spy."
He gave an abrupt order in German.
"Detail 4 men, Sergeant Major, and take him directly to the commandant. That'll keep the old sheep's head quiet for a bit. The rest break up and carry on as before. There's no one else amongst those stacks, I suppose."
Martin held his breath for the answer. Despite her unreasonable anger against him, he felt a strong liking for her.
"Nein, Herr Kapitän, all clear here."
"Very well then, march."
The detachment moved off toward the wood, whilst Martin and his escort proceeded stolidly along the road to Veldachem. There was ample time to think on the way, which Martin utilized in an endeavor to estimate his chances. Try as he would, he could not bring himself to believe that the old sheep's head would be taken in by his impersonation. Those black crosses on the Bristol were too clear an indication of the real facts of the case. By the time they reached the Commandant's headquarters, he had made up his mind to tell the truth. If he had to die, and there seemed very little doubt about his fate, he would much rather face his end as a British officer than as a Belgian spy. Besides, his confession would give the girl the satisfaction of burying her lover in his right name. But he was not to be allowed to unburden himself that night. The Commandant was in bed, and since no one dared disturb him, Martin was thrown into a cold and draughty cell to await the great man's pleasure. It was 7 o'clock on the following morning when he was paraded for the Commandant's inspection. Escorted by a section of infantry, he was marched through the streets of Veldachem to a large chateau which stood about a kilometre outside the town. Martin felt utterly miserable and friendless as he stumbled along in the midst of his guards. In a way, he was glad of the exercise after the bitter cold of the night, but he had had nothing to eat or drink since he left the British lines, and his physical endurance was sapped almost to breaking point. On all sides, he was conscious of an unusual stir of activity. Companies of stolid troops in field grey were mustering in their various units, horses were being harnessed, guns and wagons limbered, and it was clearly evident that the huge camp was preparing for a move. As the detachment approached nearer to the chateau, the long lines of tents gave way to a field aerodrome. In front of a row of canvas hangars, mechanics were busily engaged in preparing a number of Fokker two-seater biplanes for flight. Some already had their engines running, others were in process of being started. Martin estimated that the force represented 2 complete squadrons, and the familiar sight of the air screws slowly revolving to bring the water in the radiators to the required temperature for flight made him feel desperately homesick. If only he could break away from his guards and gain a sufficient lead to enable him to swarm into the cockpit of one of those fighters, he would jam the throttle lever fully open and yank her bodily into the air. The enemy could do what they liked after that. Let them fire every Archie between here and Ypres, send every aircraft they possessed to try and shoot him down. He would jolly well put up such a fight that he was bound to win, whatever the odds. Even if he failed and they scuppered him, it would not be so bad a death as the one he was now facing. At least he would have the satisfaction of dying in action instead of being shot down like a mad dog without a chance of retaliating. He groaned unhappily as he realized how hopeless the idea was. Could he succeed in breaking through the ranks on either side of him, he must inevitably be picked off before he could cover half the distance to the nearest machine. The rebound from his wild dream of escape made him more wretched than before, and when the party turned into the gates of the chateau, he was on the point of bursting into tears. The only thing that restrained him was the knowledge that any display of weakness on his part would be against the national tradition. At all costs, he must show these Huns how well a British officer could face his end. He was forcibly reminded that he was no longer a British officer, however, but a Belgian civilian, when the detachment halted in front of the house. The commandant was standing on the steps, enjoying a breath of early morning air whilst his breakfast was being prepared. At sight of the woebegone and miserable-looking figure before him, he scowled disdainfully and fixed his eyeglass in his eye.
"Um Gottes Willen, Leutnant, what do you mean by bringing that scarecrow here?"
The lieutenant in command of the party clicked his heels and delivered a stiff salute. His Excellency General von Mackenhofen was a ruthless disciplinarian.
"Orders, Herr General. He is a suspected spy brought in last night."
Von Mackenhofen scowled angrily. He had already heard about the wrecked British aircraft with the black crosses on the wings and the dead pilot fastened to his parachute. It infuriated him to think that anyone should have dared to attempt to land a spy in the area under his command.
"Take him away and shoot him,"
he said callously, and entered the house in search of his breakfast. Martin did not understand German, and the significance of the order was lost upon him. All he knew was that the detachment faced about and retired from the chateau grounds to the main road. Instead of returning to Veldachem, however, as he had anticipated, the officer in charge led his men along the edge of the flying field to a spot where the blank wall of a stone-built barn provided a convenient butt for the bullets of the firing party. It was not until a halt had been called and 2 men proceeded to tie his hands securely behind his back that it dawned on Martin that he had reached the site of his execution. For a moment or two, the shock of realization bereft him of speech. He had never dreamed he would not be given a chance to defend himself. At the very least, he had expected the commandant to demand some proof of his identity. This was terrible. It was neither right nor fair. Someone must listen to him. There was no hope that they would relent, but surely he could claim the privilege of being shot as an Englishman. Twisting his neck, he appealed to the young lieutenant who was directing operations.
"I've something important to tell you,"
he cried desperately in French.
"I—"
"Silence!" roared a burly non-commissioned officer. "Get down there, you men!"
"I'm a British officer!"
shouted Martin in English.
"I demand the right—"
The non-commissioned officer struck him brutally on the mouth with his fist, and when the lieutenant made no attempt to reprove him, Martin knew that it was useless to continue with his appeal. His thoughts were chaotic as they stood him with his back to the wall. Abject, nerve-shattering fear, resolution not to show the white feather, bitter humiliation that he had by his own act renounced his British nationality, warred in his mind for mastery.
"I must be brave,"
he muttered again and again.
"I must be brave."
It was like a hideous dream to watch the mechanical actions of the half-dozen men who had been told off to shoot him down. Under their cowled helmets, he could see their different expressions, some grim, some indifferent, some anguished. The rattle of the rifle bolts sounded harshly in his ears.
"Ready!"
bellowed the non-commissioned officer.
"Present!"
There came the pattering of hurrying feet, a shrill scream, and Clotilde appeared running swiftly towards them.
"At ease!"
snapped the lieutenant.
"Catch her, one of you, and take her away!"
Although he was utterly indifferent to the fate of an enemy spy, he drew the line at a woman witnessing the execution.
"Stop!"
shrieked Clotilde.
"Wait, it's not what you think!"
Evading the clutch of the soldier who tried to detain her, she reached the lieutenant's side and held a paper in front of his eyes.
"You see,"
she cried excitedly.
"Am I not right?"
Martin saw the young officer's eyes open wide with astonishment. He seized the paper from the girl's hand and read it eagerly.
"Himmelkreuz sacrament,"
he exclaimed.
"Where did you get this?"
She indicated the bewildered Martin.
"He gave it to me last night. He is Jacques Poulier."
"So he is. Verdammt!"
he declared fervently.
"If we had shot him, the Herr Commandant would have skinned us alive."
He gave an order, and the non-commissioned officer ran forward and released Martin's bonds. Then the party fell in once again and marched back into the chateau grounds. Clotilde walked beside Martin, gripping his arm with every appearance of a lover-like embrace.
"Courage,"
she managed to whisper.
"Follow my lead and be careful what you say."
As the troops halted for the second time in front of the house, a casement was thrown open and General von Mackenhoffen's head appeared. He was livid with rage.
"Verdammt nochmal!"
he cried, his voice high-pitched and querulous.
"What is the meaning of this, Lieutenant? When I give you an order, I expect it to be obeyed. Why in God's name have you brought that loathsome creature back here?"
The lieutenant advanced hurriedly to the window and held up the paper for his superior officer's inspection.
"The girl brought it," he explained. "She is his lover."
Von Mackenhoffen whistled softly under his breath as he read.
"So?"
he exclaimed at length, and Martin noticed that his tone was vibrant with relief.
"If he had shot this Jacques Poulier, Lieutenant, I should have made the biggest blunder of my career. You did well to bring him back, my friend, very well."
His voice changed, became charged with feverish excitement.
"Do you realize what this means?"
he cried.
"The English have lengthened their line by 15 miles without sufficient men to man the trenches, and we attack tomorrow at dawn. Gott in Himmel, we shall be in Amiens in 2 days.
He shouted to someone behind him in the room.
"Get on to operations and have von Kampendorf come over here at once. This is stupendous."
He turned to Martin and beckoned him to approach.
"I ask your pardon for this terrible mistake, Monsieur Poulier. My subordinates failed to inform me of your correct identity, and to be sure they will be punished for their carelessness. Have you breakfasted?" "You have not."
He was on the point of inviting Monsieur Poulier to join him, but the grime on the spy's tattered garments decided him against such magnanimity.
"Well, monsieur," he substituted, "suppose you go into the village, have your meal, and return here in an hour's time, yes? I have no doubt you have many things to discuss with this charming mademoiselle. See to it, Lieutenant, that Monsieur Poulier has everything he needs."
He nodded dismissal, and Martin suffered Clotilde to lead him towards the road. He could not yet understand the miracle that she had worked, changing him from a condemned prisoner to a free man, nor was he concerned to hear about it. That could wait. For the moment, his mind was concentrated on the Fokkers displayed so temptingly with engines running on the flying field.
"Tell him to go ahead and we'll meet him in the town," he said to Clotilde in response to a question from the lieutenant.
Dawdling behind as his late escort marched steadily towards Velderhem, he left the road and strayed onto the aerodrome.
"Where are you going?"
asked Clotilde interestedly. "Back to France," declared Martin grimly. "When you come." She nodded resolutely.
"Si, si, Monsieur Anglais. If I stay behind, they will certainly kill me."
No one took any notice of them as they strolled across the grass. Martin halted alongside the outermost machine. Swinging the girl into the rear cockpit, he swarmed onto the wing and settled himself at the controls. There was a sudden shout of alarm. Grey figures came running, but they were too late. Martin opened the throttle to its fullest extent. The Fokker began to move, gathered speed. He eased back the control column and lifted her cleanly in a climbing turn, headed east. Looking back at the feverish activity that followed his departure, he laughed triumphantly. They would never catch him now. He was safe, thanks to the wit of a girl. Clotilde told him all about it when they had landed in the British lines. The papers he had given her to destroy revealed that Jacques Poulier had been acting for the Germans as well as the British.
"To think that I had ever loved a man like that,"
declared Clotilde disgustedly.
"He was one grand cochon, that one, and I was so very cross because you took his clothes."
"I've taken his place too," announced Martin significantly. Mischievously, she pretended not to understand.
"Of course you can tell your colonel that the Germans attack at dawn. You have it on the authority of General von Mackenhofen."
Martin shook his head. "I'll leave you to tell him that. What I propose to tell him is that I want special leave to marry the bravest girl in Belgium."